Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, frost at the fiscal cliff, Palestinians celebrate a UN vote, Egypt in uproar. President Obama was in campaign mode on fiscal cliff negotiations. His ace in the hole, keeping middle class taxes low.
I'll do whatever it takes to get this done. It's too important for Washington to screw this up. Now's the time for us to work on what we all agree to, which is let's keep middle class taxes low.
House Speaker John Boehner heard some details of White House plans yesterday. His reaction, get serious.
I remain hopeful that productive conversations can be had in the days ahead. But the White House has to get serious.
And applause at the UN as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas addressed the General Assembly just before an overwhelming vote granting Palestine observer state status, that touch of statehood.
We did not come here to add further complications to the peace process, which Israel's policies have thrown into the intensive care unit. Rather, we came to launch a final, serious attempt to achieve peace.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kristen Welker of NBC News, Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Fiscal cliff, Egypt, Palestine, Powerball. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from the White House is Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen Welker, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And from New York, Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs, is with us. Gideon, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kristen, and Gideon.
Kristen, take us right in here, if you would. The president's guy, Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary, on Capitol Hill with John Boehner yesterday, laying out some details. Boehner very dismissive of those after Geithner took off. What did Geithner bring down to Congress, Kristen?
Well, Tom, part of the offer is a lot of what we saw in the president's budget proposal of last year. It includes $1.6 trillion in new taxes, $400 billion in tax cuts to Medicare and other entitlements, and about $50 billion in stimulus spending. One of the new components of the proposal is to end congressional control over the size of the national debt, essentially getting rid of the fiscal cliff, the Congress's control of the fiscal cliff, so that we won't have another ugly battle like we saw last year. I should say the debt ceiling, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Republicans were very resistant to this plan, essentially saying that the $1.6 trillion in tax increases is just a non-starter. It's twice what they would ever consider. And they say that they want to see more cuts to entitlements. And they also take issue with ending congressional control over the size of the national debt. So the Republicans really balking at the plan yesterday.
Let me ask you just about that piece, Kristen. What is the White House argument for taking away congressional oversight of the national debt ceiling? That seems like a pretty big deal. And to just hand it to a president, this president or any other, seems like an awful lot of power. Just let it go up and up without congressional oversight. What's the argument for that move?
And that's exactly what Republicans say. They say that it's too much control, and they say that, quite frankly, the public, members of Congress, should have a role in when to increase the debt limit. But the White House says that the argument has just become so divisive, that it has become such a difficult issue to resolve, that they don't ever want to basically see what happened last summer, which is when we really saw negotiations between the White House lawmakers on Capitol Hill devolve the United States credit rating downgraded,
yeah.
And really left a black eye on lawmakers on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue.
We can see why they don't want to get back into that. On the other hand, that's a lot of power just to give the White House. Kristen, Gideon, Jack, here's Speaker Boehner yesterday talking about his meeting with Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and the White House's opening proposal, at least in that setting, to avert the fiscal cliff.
First, despite the claims that the president supports a balanced approach, the Democrats have yet to get serious about real spending cuts. And secondly, no substantive progress has been made in the talks between the White House and the House over the last 2 weeks.
Okay, we've seen a lot of shuttling back and forth and people expressing confidence, Jack, that this was going to happen because it had to happen, and kind of, you know, half smiles here, but the veneer kind of came off there. What about spending? Here's the president saying, you know, he's got $1.6 trillion in taxes, that he needs $400 billion in cuts, a lot of that coming from I think Medicare and upper income people would pay more for it. Does the White House need to step up bigger with spending cuts here, Jack?
Almost certainly, to get the Republicans to go along with anything like that dimension of tax increase. But, you know, if you look at this Obama opening move as an economic proposition, it's hard to see that it does much harm. I mean, yes, there'll be a fiscal drag because of raising taxes, offset by a stimulus, more infrastructure spending, also offset by continuing the payroll tax cut. And it gets high marks, it seems to me, this does, on the grounds of inequality, at a time when inequality, according to a recent study, is higher than any time since 1917. This increases the estate tax. It taxes dividends at the same level as ordinary income. These are pluses from that point of view. So it doesn't look like it does much economic harm. It might do some social good. It's a political non-starter.
John Boehner says, get serious, Mr. President. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said that progress was slow. He put the blame for that on Republicans.
It's been weeks, at least 2 weeks, since we met at the White House. We're still waiting for a serious offer from the Republicans. Really, now is the time for the Republicans to move past this happy talk about revenues, ill-defined, of course, and put specifics on the table. The president has made his proposal. We need a proposal from them.
Need a proposal from them. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Evansville, Indiana, Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to state an opinion that President Obama ran on the platform that he was going to raise the taxes at the top 2% and keep the 98% the middle class the tax low. We need President Obama to do that. So the Republicans need to sit back and follow that plan and listen to whatever he has to put out, make sure, you know, and go with it. That's what the people spoke. That's what we want.
The people spoke. That's what they. And Jim, I'm reading here. You're a trucker out of Florida on the road in Indiana right now. I mean, when you go to the truck stops, does everybody agree with you, or do they say, "Hey, wait a minute, Jim"?
A lot of them say, "Wait a minute, Jim." There's a lot of truck drivers that believe the opposite way that I do. For whatever reason, in this industry, we work hard. We don't make a whole lot of money. We do okay. Our pay is dependent on what miles we get, so I'm a little surprised that they feel that way, but there is a lot of different opinion out on the road here.
Jim, I appreciate your call very much. Kristen, what do Republicans say to this argument that Jim gives us off the road there in Indiana? Look, the president said he wanted to raise taxes on the upper income earners. Now, he got reelected. That's a mandate. Let's do it.
Well, Republicans are saying, look, they still have a majority in the House. They still believe that they have, to some extent, a mandate to keep taxes low. But the point that Jim brings up is so interesting, because President Obama, the White House, really believe that they have a fair amount of leverage in this, because the president did, after all, win re-election. In addition to that, if you kind of think back to some of the past negotiations, the payroll tax cut fight, the debt ceiling debate, which we've talked about just a few minutes ago, Democrats hammered President Obama for not being strong enough in his opening offers. I think that part of this opening offer reflects the president's desire to sort of come at Republicans from a stronger standpoint, to come at them really offering less off the top. Of course, you heard House Speaker John Boehner really digging in his heels yesterday, and Democrats are saying, well, what do you want to see in terms of cuts to entitlements? Put your plan on the table. So Democrats are basically saying, look, the ball's in your court. But I do think that Jim brings up a really crucial issue, which is that the president believes he's got the leverage here.
Some interesting back and forth on this yesterday, and maybe some fissures on the Republican side. I don't know. Here was Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, took the Senate floor, attacked Democrats for wanting to increase tax rates on upper income earners.
The only reason Democrats are insisting on raising rates is because raising rates on the so-called rich is the holy grail of liberalism. The holy grail of liberalism. Their aim isn't job creation. They're interested in wealth destruction.
Wealth destruction, charges Mitch McConnell, but Republican Congressman Tom Cole, Oklahoma, very prominent. Here he was Wednesday. This happened to be with MSNBC's Chris Matthews, but Cole saying, well, maybe we should go along with making sure rates don't go up on the middle class. Here's Tom Cole.
If the president's willing to accept 80% of the Bush tax cuts for 98% of the American people and make them permanent, I think that is a point we should agree on, do that, and then continue to fight for the things that we believe in. Simply because we accept that part of his offer doesn't mean that we have to agree with the rest.
Kristen, there was Tom Cole. That really turned people's heads. He wasn't the only one. Grover Norquist's tax pledge, no tax pledge, hanging out there and people saying maybe that dam is breaking. What's it look like at the end of the week, Kristen? Dam breaking or not?
Well, a couple of points there. First of all, some people are arguing that Cole is actually giving Boehner some coverage here to say, you know, to sort of play devil's advocate and mm-hmm. to say, hey, well, maybe we should actually
We're
go
thinking
along
about
with
it.
The president.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. So it could be a political move. But as you point out, look, there are other Republican lawmakers that are starting to give, it seems like. Graham, Representative King was very strong on this point on the Sunday talk mm-hmm. shows, saying that a pledge that you signed 20 years ago, 18 years ago, you know, is that for Congress? For instance, if I were in Congress in 1941, I would have signed a declaration of war against Japan. I'm not going to attack Japan again today. So you do see Republicans starting to give on this issue. And what's also interesting is that you're hearing a somewhat tempered tone from Grover Norquist. He hasn't come out with some of the same sort of threats that he has in the past.
Well, maybe not. We'll look at that, right? Kristen, stand by. It's so great to have you. Kristen Welker of NBC News. Gideon Rose, we're going to come to you right away. Gideon, on editor of Foreign Affairs, Jack Beatty. We're looking at a big week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Getting frosty, things are at the fiscal cliff, Palestinian statehood, at the UN, Egypt in uproar, Romney and Obama at lunch at the White House, a little Powerball badness out there as well. A lot of flux this week. Flux in Washington, in Egypt, in Syria. Gideon Rose is with us, editor of Foreign Affairs, joins us from New York City. Kristen Welker is here, White House correspondent for NBC News. Jack Beatty, our own news analyst, is here, and you can join us. Who's carrying your torch in the fiscal cliff conversation? Can we get past the same old deja vu? Is this country governable? What do you make of the lonely U.S. and Israel votes against Palestinian observer state status at the U.N.? Why did this vote go so heavily the other way? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Lots of callers here. John, Richmond, Vermont. You're on the air, John.
Hello, Tom. How are you today?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, I'm curious as to why the negotiations are essentially being done in public. They did that before the election, and I don't see any change. They go behind closed doors, and then they come out and disparage the opposite side. It to me looks like it's a big game of CYA. Everybody's looking to have an exit strategy, and what we need is a single statesman. And what we have is a lot of politicians playing the same game they were playing before the election. It's very discouraging to me because I don't think they're serious.
Well, I know what you mean. It'd be nice to get something done here. On the other hand, a single statesman, this is one of those that's going to take two to tango sooner or later. I mean, Jack, what about this sort of feeling that, wait a minute, we had an election, and doesn't it change anything? Are we really right back in that same old 2011 summer that Kristen reminds us of, where there was talk, and then just posing and collapse?
Well, you can certainly make a case for that. Democrats point to the polls. They say 60% of the people want what Obama wants. Tax cut for 98%, tax increase for 2%. That's true, but just about 60% of Republicans don't want that. And when you look at the ratios here in the House, 85% of House GOP incumbents were reelected with 55% or more of the vote. They are from very, very red districts. There aren't, you know, there aren't votes there for necessarily for compromise. If 60% of Republicans don't want what Obama wants, and these representatives are, are channeling their constituents, and then you say, well, can Obama get votes there? Well, you know, in this new film, in the Spielberg movie Lincoln, we have a picture of Lincoln hunting around and trying to get 20 Democratic votes for the 13th Amendment.
Wonderful film. Everybody ought to see it.
Everybody. Well, you know, I've looked at this, and there are 19 House Republicans retiring. There are 16 lame ducks who are defeated. That gives you 35. The Democrats need 25 of those 35 to pass, even by one vote, what Obama wants. Is there something like a scramble, perhaps even offers of postmasterships to some of these lame ducks? We don't know.
A little job in the Gideon Rose, you're watching the whole world here. Europe's been going through a kind of version of this struggle in Washington right now with all of its issues around money and who's going to pay for what and what kind of borrowing is available. I mean, what do you think, Gideon, of the process? Our caller says the process isn't right here. What do you think of the process in the United States about grappling with these giant fiscal issues? I don't know, compared with anybody else who's trying to do it around the world that you're watching.
Actually, I think all the stories we're talking about are the same story, whether it's the fiscal cliff in the United States or European debt and spending, whether it's the Egyptian constitution or the Syrian civil war. What you're looking at is exactly the same thing, which is how does a country with sharply divided political forces find some way to come together and move forward on major challenges of national policy. And in fact, you could teach a great course in comparative politics just by looking at the ways these issues, the same issue, is playing out in different countries. In a place like Syria, where you have an absolute breakdown of political order, you have full-scale civil war.
Yep.
40,000 people dying, rebels trying to take the airport,
worst-case
the government
scenario.
Shutting down the internet. Yep. So you have actual combat. In Egypt, a new democracy where a regime has been toppled. You have people who and political forces that are unused to democratic procedures trying to work within the constitutional battle, trying to work within street protests, but not really knowing how to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have lots of jawboning, the Constitution being a vehicle for this battle between the forces in society, street protests and counter demonstrations. In the United States, you have a peaceful system in which no one's actually taking to the streets either to shoot anybody else or even to have massive protests.
Well, a little bit over the last year and some, but yeah, okay, in general.
But you
yes.
have the same basic issue in terms of, okay, even if you have a democratic procedure, how do you manage to find some way to accommodate both the majority forces that win elections and yet enough of buy-in from the opposition to move forward as a whole country? Because we don't have a winner-take-all political system. We don't even have a parliamentary system in which the national government, if you win an election, you get a majority.
Right.
So our system is designed, our democracy was designed not to do things. It was not designed to actually achieve things. The founders wanted to frustrate too much political authority
activism
in Washington.
Yeah.
And so we're getting exactly what the founders wanted, which is you don't have any kind of danger of real tyranny, but you do have a very difficult challenge in debating what you're going to do to move forward. I think much of the posturing on the fiscal cliff, though, is just that, because this is different from 2011, because at the end of the year, the situation is going to change radically and in a way that, frankly, I think gives the Democrats a lot more leverage this time around.
Well,
so this is skirmishing that you're seeing, but as it gets closer to the end of the year, things will heat up. And then you're actually going to see the real action moving forward.
Well, that's what everybody's looking toward. I mean, Kristen, you know, the question that comes up here is American governability. With our polarization, yes, we weren't. It was designed not to do a whole lot, but at least there was for a long time a kind of consensus compared to now on how to move forward. Now that's broken down. We've had an election. Here's the president. We know that his crew is pretty good at counting votes. They showed that this month in the presidential election. Is he counting noses like Abe Lincoln on the Hill? Does he see it's never going
to
happen?
I was just going to go back to Lincoln. And as you know, the president had a viewing of that movie here in the White House. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of wondering if he was inspired to get engaged a little bit more in reaching out to individual lawmakers after having watched that film. Because what we saw in that film was the messiness of the political system. And you saw Lincoln getting into the trenches with these individual lawmakers, taking his case to these individual lawmakers to get the 13th Amendment passed. In this case, and I know that one of your listeners called in and said that a lot of this is unfolding publicly, but it is also unfolding in private as well. President Obama reached out to congressional leaders this weekend. He also had a half-hour conversation with House Speaker John Boehner the other night. So there is some maneuvering going on behind the scenes.
We were told that did not go well. I mean, that was the headline out of that. Do you think that maybe there's something cozier going on than we know?
Well, I don't know if there's anything cozier. I do think that the president during that phone call did reiterate that he would not accept a deal that didn't increase taxes on wealthier Americans. And, you know, he's traveling to Pennsylvania today to sort of add the pressure on congressional Republicans to get on board with his plan to do exactly that. But I do think that there are a lot of these conversations going on in private. Rob Neighbors was on the Hill yesterday meeting with lawmakers, but also having conversations on the sidelines on his phone. So they are counting votes. And I think the president really is engaging in more outreach to lawmakers on the Hill. And as you also remember, over the past year, he's been criticized for not doing that enough. Sure. And you heard in his first press conference, the president saying, essentially admitting that he needs to do a better job of that. And I think that he is, at least at this point, making a broader effort, really, to reach out to lawmakers on the Hill to try to get those votes.
We'll see. Rob Neighbors, the White House conduit to Congress there. Bob in Wells River, Vermont. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show.
Thank you.
My point is that I think it's a little disingenuous of the Republicans to be calling for cuts in entitlements, 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 when one of the main reasons we've gotten ourselves into this position is that we've just gone through two very expensive wars, and wars need to be paid for. And for the Republicans to suggest that we should never, ever raise taxes is to put us, I believe, at a very great disadvantage, especially in the upcoming looming line in the sand with Iran. What if we have to go to war with Iran to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon, which, from what I can read, seems to be the general consensus of what we would do?
Well, I mean, you can look at that a lot of ways. You could look at that and say, well, you know, we can't afford that, and we don't want the taxes, so let's not do it. But, yeah, point taken, there has been a lot that has not been paid for, and that pledge Grover Norquist has been pretty tough through all that time. He was talking this week. He was in an interview with Fox News on Tuesday. Grover Norquist attacking Republicans who maybe seem to be straying or thinking about it from his anti-tax pledge.
One, they're undermining Boehner. They're undermining Mitch McConnell, who have held the Republicans together against Obama's agenda very well for 4 years. They're throwing marbles at the feet of their leadership. So that's not helpful. Two, they're turning to the people who voted for them and saying, you know, I promised you something. Nah, no, I'm not. I changed my mind. You're not important enough to keep my word to.
Grover Norquist, don't throw marbles under the feet of the Republican leadership. Then there was an election, on the other hand. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
You know, Tom, where do I start? Wait a minute. How about I start right here? We won the election. America won. Reaganomics lost. Trickle-down economy lost. Radical Republicanism lost.
Well, who's we, Carl? There's a lot of people on the other side of that ledger, too, and they've still got a lot of congressmen.
America is we. We won. And so Republicans, they don't have any cards to play with. They don't have any chips to bring to the game.
What about their majority in the House of Representatives?
Time is not on their side. Let it go off the cliff. They don't have any chips. Listen, on one side, they're saying, Republicans are saying, let's raise taxes and lower taxes for the riches of the rich. And on the other side, they're saying, on the entitlement, let's cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They want to decimate the poor, at the same time give more gifts to the riches of the rich. They're in a heck of a position, and my thing is just to tell the president, we're behind you. Go out on the bully pulpit and bash their head every day with this information.
It's not sweetness and light. It's leverage. We hear it, Carl. Kristen, how about it? How do you see the White House calculating the bottom line leverage, chips, if you want, here in this debate? And what about if it just does? Do they think that GOP is going to have to come around? Or is the president willing to go off the cliff because the damage would be greater on the other, quote-unquote, side?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of both. First of all, I think that you are going to see some entitlement reform, if not substantially, in the immediate actions that will be taken in the future, in the near future. You remember President Obama saying a year ago, it's time to eat our peas. I think they still have that view, that they are going to have to get Democrats on board with some entitlement reform. Having said that, I think that the White House of this administration really believes that they have the chips in this instance, that they do have the leverage. And I think you're going to see the president really take a tougher line and hold out on giving in to the Republican demands for more than we have seen in the past. So that's how it looks right now. Remember, there's one thing sort of hanging over all of this, which is the economy. And if lawmakers do go over the fiscal cliff, economists have said that we could slip back into another recession, that the unemployment rate could go back up to 9.1%. So there is a lot of posturing right now, a lot of angry words. But what's really hanging over all of this, I think, is a real sense that they need to get something done before January 1st, because if they don't, it could harm the economy. And I don't think these lawmakers want to see that happen. You remember after the debt ceiling fight, Congress experienced some of its lowest approval ratings in history. And that could happen again if they don't strike a deal.
I don't know if I just don't know if they care about that anymore. Somehow a lot of people get reelected anyway, but we'll see. It is going to be a heck of an interesting month ahead. If I may, I want to turn to that vote in the UN yesterday, observer state status for the Palestinians, for Palestine. Here was the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas addressing the UN General Assembly just before the vote came, 138-9, 41 abstaining to upgrade the status to non-member observer state at the UN. Here he is through a translator.
Palestine comes today to the General Assembly because it believes in peace and because its people, as proven in past days, are in desperate need of it. Palestine comes today to this prestigious international forum, representative and protector of international legitimacy, reaffirming our conviction that the international community now stands before the last chance to save the two-state solution.
Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, through a translator there yesterday at the UN. And here, the Israeli UN ambassador, Ron Proser, saying the resolution would do nothing for Israeli-Palestinian peace.
For as long as President Abbas prefers symbolism over reality, as long as he prefers to travel to New York for UN resolutions rather than travel to Jerusalem for genuine dialogue, any hope of peace will be out of reach.
Gideon Rose, I'm sure you were watching and listening closely. What do you see as the bottom line out of this vote? Where does this leave this relationship? What does this move, if anything?
Well, it doesn't move things very far. It is indeed symbolism. Look, for the last couple of years, the world has been consumed with the stories coming out of the Middle East about the Arab Spring. And whatever one thinks about the future direction of the Arab Spring and political reform in the region or the Syrian civil war, the one thing you can't say is that Palestinians and the Israeli-Palestinian relationship or Israeli-Arab relationship had anything to do with any of that. And so the Palestinians found themselves on the sidelines. And what you have recently, very interestingly, is you have the two divided forces in the Palestinian community, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza, trying to make themselves relevant and get the Palestinian issue back to the news. Hamas, which has a military strategy of military struggle and resistance, did so by firing rockets or allowing rockets to be fired, and Israel slapped back with the recent conflict in Gaza. Hamas, the Palestinian Authority, is trying a legal track towards statehood and is pushing international recognition, the UN vote, and so forth. Unfortunately, neither the PA nor Hamas actually wants to deal with the real issue, just like the Israelis don't, which is how do you get the Israelis and the Palestinians to agree on some common framework for moving together in which the major concerns of each side are actually addressed? Nobody wants to deal with those things because nobody wants to make the compromises that that would involve. And so everybody, whether it's Hamas or whether it's the PA or frankly, whether it's Israel, is trying to avoid the main topic of discussion by going off into sidelines. And so this is yet another distraction from the actual real questions that can only be settled by negotiations among the parties directly themselves.
I mean, you say sideline and distraction. You may be right, but, look at the video footage of Palestinians celebrating in the streets. Maybe they're just hungry for something to celebrate. But you could feel, they feel like they got something with this. We'll come back and look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, President Obama hosted his vanquished Republican rival Mitt Romney for lunch at the White House. It was off limits to the press, but fair game for late-night television host Conan O'Brien.
Today, Mitt Romney had lunch with President Obama. They had lunch. There was an awkward moment when the bill came and Obama only offered to pay 47%.
No end to the fun. Powerball fever swept America with a huge $587 million jackpot. Two winning tickets. Here's Joe Renke in Dearborn, Missouri, where one of those tickets was bought. He thought he'd be the one.
Yeah, I'm going to win. But I didn't. But I'm happy for whoever won it.
And the Rolling Stones kicked off their 50th anniversary tour with a big show in London, kicked it off with a nod to the Beatles, this Lennon-McCartney tune.
I want to be your lover, baby. I want to be your man.
We're looking at a week in the news, getting frosty at the fiscal cliff, Palestinian statehood at the UN, Egypt in uproar, Romney and Obama at lunch. Kristen Welker is with us, White House correspondent for NBC News. Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs, is with us from New York. Jack Beatty's here. We've still got this Palestinian issue with us here. And Susan Rice, they came together when she spoke yesterday at the UN, the UN ambassador of the United States, saying the vote would only stand in the way of a lasting peace in the Middle East.
Today's grand pronouncements will soon fade, and the Palestinian people will wake up tomorrow and find that little about their lives has changed, save that the prospects of a durable peace have only receded.
Susan Rice at the UN yesterday. Let's hear from our listeners. Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, isn't it, that the whole world is wrong, but the United States and Israel are right? I think it's time that the United States got real, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think Congress is out of touch with the rest of the world around them. I think the American public as a whole are out of touch with the world around them. It's impossible to make peace with the Israelis as long as they are going to continue to build on the West Bank land and they start breaking their own agreements. For example, they'll declare a ceasefire, but they'll continue assassinations. They'll declare a moratorium on building, but they'll find some excuse to build anyhow. The world cannot possibly be wrong. It can't all be anti-Semitic.
What about the other side of that ledger, about the Israelis with the rockets coming down on them and all the rest?
Yeah, well, let's take a look at that ledger. How many people died on one side and how many people died on the other? And the other factor is when you've got this frustration level this high, what is left? Look, I don't justify rockets going over the border, but I also don't justify this piecemeal destruction of a people.
Bill, let us pick it up right there, if we may. And Gideon, I'll bring this one first to you. I mean, just let's look at the vote. And how do you interpret this vote? 138 countries voted in favor of observer state status for the Palestinians. 9 opposed. That included Israel, of course, and the U.S. Canada was in there. The Czech Republic, Panama, and then it gets down to little Pacific islands, you know, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau. But how do you interpret that vote and the meaning of it? You hear what our caller has to say about it, Gideon.
I hear what the caller has to say. I'm a little more cynical. I think large-scale votes in the UN General Assembly are kind of equivalent to large-scale votes in Congress, which is if you have anything that passes Congress, 100-0 in the Senate or by comparable majorities in the House, it's either a totally irrelevant and meaningless thing like, you know, National Turkey Day, or it's something that is a, you know, a hortatory, passive proclamation, we should do something about problem X without actually saying what it is. Because real issues don't actually produce that massive degree of consensus. And this is a case in which a lot of countries at the UN essentially find it very easy and appropriate to sort of register a vote in support of a what seems to be a beleaguered minority without actually paying any price for it or having any constructive solution.
But why vote that way? I mean, are you painting all these countries as thoughtless in this? I mean, a reasonable person could still look at those numbers and say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Why are we down here with Micronesia and Palau and Nauru?
Oh, look, the question of whether the United States should oppose it and at what point, should the Israelis have to be forced to deal with these things themselves and address the problem, that's a real issue. And clearly there are obviously all sorts of things Israel can and should do with regard to the peace process and with regard to the Palestinians. But the idea that the sort of Palestinian statehood track at the UN is a major constructive route, it's another unilateral attempt to avoid dealing with the issues rather than a route through them. And, the United States is trying to get Israel's back, and so that's why it votes against it. But I don't think the vote itself is a sign of people are checking off this vote in the UN rather than being passionate about it because they're putting themselves on record in the same way that many members of Congress will put themselves on record in exactly the opposite way. Even people who can barely put Israel on a map, they don't want to get on the wrong side of various pressure groups or interest groups or the general feeling of their constituents. So they'll just simply check off a box and sign on to a resolution. And that's frankly what I think a lot of countries are doing here now.
I want to bring it around to Susan Rice. She was right there on the floor of the UN yesterday speaking up, and President Obama, with her being grilled this week, was very forthright. Here's just a little clip, but this was from, I think it was a cabinet meeting. During a cabinet meeting midweek, he called her extraordinary in response to a question over whether she was being treated fairly in her meetings this week with GOP critics.
Susan Rice is extraordinary. Couldn't be prouder of the job that she's done at USUN.
Couldn't be prouder, says the president, looking at her as a potential next Secretary of State. But here was Republican Senator Susan Collins, a moderate Republican senator, on Wednesday after that meeting with U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice on Capitol Hill, she and other Republicans meeting there. Here was Senator Collins airing concerns over Rice's role in the aftermath of the Benghazi embassy attack.
I continue to be troubled by the fact that the UN ambassador decided to play what was essentially a political role at the height of a contentious presidential election campaign by agreeing to go on the Sunday shows to present the administration's position.
Kristen Welker, you're there at the White House. Help us understand what's going on with this Susan Rice. I mean, it's not even a formal nomination. We don't even know if she should be the one for sure. But with the president's, super embrace of her and these Republican senators' super criticism of her, what's going on?
Right. Well, first of all, I'm told we could get a nomination as early as next week, and I want to stress
of her
that
or
word
somebody.
Could, of somebody. So I want to stress that word could, because, of course, the White House is being fairly tight-lipped about this entire process. I think the comments by Senator Collins are potentially worrying to the White House. As you point out, she is moderate. She is certainly someone who could potentially vote for Susan Rice if she were, in fact, nominated. But I've been speaking to senior administration officials, asking them if the president is dissuaded by this backlash that we have seen this week from a number of senators, including Senator McCain, Senator Ayotte, Graham, who all sat down with Susan Rice and essentially came out of those meetings saying that they have more questions about her handling of the Benghazi incident than when they went into those meetings. And senior administration officials tell me that what the president is saying publicly really represents what's happening privately as well, that he still has complete confidence in Susan Rice and that he believes that she were nominated, that she still would be confirmed. So I don't think anything has changed at this point. Of course, we'll have to see what develops over the coming days. But President Obama expressing confidence in her publicly. We also heard Secretary of State Clinton echoing the remarks of the president. So senior administration officials tell me that the president has not been dissuaded by this backlash that we're seeing on the Hill.
Well, there is a kind of fervent quality to his embrace of her. Explain that for us. Is he just ticked off at being pushed by senators here? Does he have some particular loyalty to her? I mean, there are others, presumably, who could be Secretary of State. What's up with that kind of emotional quality to his defense of Susan Rice?
Well, I think that it's both. I think that you're right. He probably is a little bit irritated by feeling as though he's being pushed around. But also, he has a long relationship with Susan Rice. And obviously, she's someone who also served in the Clinton administration. So he does feel a sense of loyalty to her. And aides say that they have a very strong working relationship. Does that mean he's going to choose her? Not necessarily. Remember, a lot of people are saying that if Senator Kerry were nominated, he would essentially sail through that process. And we saw Senator Kerry playing a very large role, helping President Obama to prepare for the debates and that sort of thing in the run-up to the campaign. So I certainly would not suggest that Susan Rice is going to be the definitive choice. But I think that the president is basically saying, I'm not going to be pushed around. I just won re-election. And this is someone in whom I have great confidence.
Let's go to Elizabeth calling from Henderson, Kentucky. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
All right. What do you think?
Okay. If what I heard about Susan Rice is true, they said that she knew what was going on in Benghazi, and they told them not to interfere. I don't think she should be anything. I think she should be put in jail for murder. Some of our people got killed over there for no reason whatsoever, and they didn't do anything to defend them.
And Elizabeth, what's your source for? Where did you hear that? Where do you get that?
I heard that on the radio. I mean, I don't know if she had anything to do with it, but she was out there telling everybody that they didn't know anything about it. Now, I heard another radio saying that because, you know, I travel from state to state, so I have to keep sending the channels, and I heard on another radio that they had satellites and they could see what was going on, and they still told them not to interfere.
Right. Elizabeth, I appreciate your call. There's a lot of that kind of criticism. We do know that there were a lot of forces who were mustered and some were in the air and some were trying to get there and some did get there and many did not, couldn't get there quickly enough. But you can hear just how fraught it is out there. Fox, Elizabeth, thank you. Fox in Owensboro, Kentucky. Fox, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you think?
What I wanted to say is I support the president's nomination with Ms. Rice. I believe that she went on the information she was given by intelligence. And the only thing that she would be guilty of is speaking too soon before she got the full information. Other than that, I think her experience in the past has made her a good nomination for for her position.
Fox, we've got it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Gideon Rose, step in here. Elizabeth says she's heard, she knew, didn't act, got him killed. Fox says, come on, all she's guilty of here is speaking too soon. Good nominee. What do you see happening here?
Let me be clear on this. I don't know any nonpartisan foreign policy expert who thinks this Benghazi flap with Susan Rice is anything other than a completely absurd political controversy that is totally trivial. I was going to say I don't know any serious person who doesn't think that, but I do know a few serious people who think it, but they're all hardcore Republicans with a vested partisan interest. So this is just Susan Rice is the UN ambassador. She was not involved in embassy security. It's not clear that she was doing anything other than reading the talking points that she was given. She was acting as an administration spokesman, which she does every day.
Was she
UN.
Giving too enthusiastic political cover to the White House in the heat of the home stretch to the election?
Compared to what every single other cabinet member does at every single other point during every single other administration? No. She was acting as the president's representative. She was it's just silly. There are various reasons one could like or not like Susan Rice. Mm-hmm. The president's probably going to get her as his choice because this is the president's personal choice, and by and large, you're going to give them that unless there's some major dramatic failure. But one of the reasons I think the president is upset by this, quite apart from his views about Rice, is that he thinks this is a totally bogus thing. If you were to allow this to get to have her blocked by this, essentially you'd be saying you can cook up a controversy out of whole cloth and then use it as an excuse to deny anybody you don't want a post. And that's kind of a silly thing. So, whether or not Susan Rice is the person I would pick for Secretary of State, the idea that she wouldn't get it because of this is really as sad a comment about American politics on substance as the fiscal cliff debates are about its domestic policy stuff.
Jack, I wonder, I mean, people died here. Do you see a controversy out of whole cloth or not?
Well, I think there's a large element of that. But look at the sequence here. Over the weekend, Lindsey Graham and John McCain both seemed to open the door to a amicable understanding. The headlines the next day was, you know, McCain backs off. And there was this, he's going to have a meeting, and I heard people flat out say, they'll have this meeting. She'll come in and show her diplomatic skills by solving the, you know, the senatorial egos and reassuring them. And they'll come out and they'll say, well, we still have concerns. But after talking to Ambassador Rice today, we feel that she's on the right track. What happened? She met with them, and including not just the three, Ayotte and McCain, et cetera, but also with Susan Collins. And they all said, this is worse.
Her fault or theirs, Jack? Her fault or theirs?
I'm not. I don't know, Tom. I don't know. I'm just saying that you can almost see a vertiginous snap there. I mean, we go from looks good for her to they meet with her. Her diplomatic skills are wanting, at least in those meetings, and out. And, you know, it looks worse for her.
Well, that's going to be something to watch. And Lord knows there's enough going on out in the world. I mean, Gideon, Egypt, are they headed toward a constitution that looks to you like one that could be the foundation, even with Morsi's grab for bigger powers, a foundation for an some kind of optimistic future there or not? They're on a fast track.
You know, we really don't know. Obviously, the recent attempt to make the there are some good things about the new constitution that they're drafting, but there are also some bad things. It does have too much opportunity for the military to retain in power, and they're inside the government, and there are some other issues about the Morsi's being subject to various kinds of control. So there's a danger that it has the potential for abuse, but on the other hand, the real issue here is not going to be the formal constitution, but how the forces in Egyptian society balance each other and play out. And the real question is, are you going to have a contested political system in which different forces essentially have to compromise, or are you going to have one in which a sort of winner-take-all arises and a recreation of some new kind of dictatorship, whether it's a military one or a theocratic one by the Muslim Brotherhood or so forth? No one really knows right now. We all hope that it goes in a more contested way and that they manage to work through this. What they're doing, by the way, I should point out, is standard par for the course in new democracies. So it doesn't say anything about Islam or about the Muslim Brotherhood or about Egypt. But that doesn't mean it's going to turn out well. It may well turn out badly before it gets better in the long run.
Well, all kinds of hopes there, but also room for mess in that region and beyond. We're going to be talking right here on Monday about the law in American drones. They've been very active. There's a big debate going on about what the rules, what the law should be about how those are used. Kristen, more cabinet changes coming up. In a word, when are we going to start to see those?
Well, I think we're going to start to see them start to trickle in before the inauguration. By the way, I should say inauguration preps are underway. They're starting to build some of the stages outside the White House.
And on Turns History, Kristen, the clock is on. It's NBC News. Thank you so much. Gideon Rose, Foreign Affairs, thanks for being here. And Jack, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.